Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I've got an episode here for you that we're going to call a blast from the past. And that's because we've got travel going on for a bunch of us, some other things. Some people are moving in the Disaster Podcast world here, and we just could not get together to get an episode out this week. And we decided to, we've had over 7 years of excellent content, and we thought we'd revisit some things that would be pertinent this week. And because there's a current dip in the jet stream and bringing a bunch of cold weather to the middle and eastern parts of the United States, we thought we would jump in and revisit an episode that we covered back in 2015. On managing very cold weather, managing the homeless and people from an emergency management standpoint, and then also talking a little bit about cold weather emergencies and treatment of cold weather emergency problems. We have Dr. Joe Holly on this call and my co-host Sam Bradley as well. And so I just wanted to thank you all for checking out this episode. We're gonna call it a revisit of cold weather emergencies. And I will turn things over as we jump back in to this episode with Sam Bradley, Joe Holly, and myself coming up next.
So, Jamie, what's it like back there? Like it skirted around you, I guess, but the worst of it. How cold is it?
Well, it's been pretty much, normal January temperatures here. It was about 13 degrees this morning when I got up. And so it was a little brisk taking the kids to school and moving around. But, it's a big cold front's coming through. The cold low temperature on Monday is supposed to be around -2 to 0 degrees, somewhere in there.
Oh, my God.
And we're supposed to get another round of snow starting in the afternoon on Super Bowl Sunday. So those of you that are listening to this show, if you're listening to it after the fact, we're recording this right before Super Bowl Sunday, and the weather supposed to get a little bit of a storm coming up, hitting us again Super Bowl Sunday night and into Monday. So we'll see. There's a lot of things in the news, Sam, about people disappointed with the overblown predictions for certain areas. People in New Jersey and New York City didn't think it warranted the emergency response that and preparations that were put in place there. And yet, within an hour's drive of New York City, places were getting in excess of 2 feet of snow. And on the coastal areas, some extreme storm surge. And so I think, it's important for us to understand that in disasters, it's not an exact science. And when we do have some warning, we need to take appropriate precautions and be prepared, but also be a little thankful when it doesn't hit exactly the way that people predict it will.
And exactly. And think about it the other way around. If there was no preparation or people weren't doing a whole lot to prepare the area and then a big one did hit, who's going to take the blame for that? So where do you go here? I mean, I'd rather be extra prepared and not have it happen than the other way around. So what kind of issues do you run into when you have this kind of weather? I can see I'm envisioning all these people socked in to Super Bowl Sunday with all their nachos in their beer and hopefully not have to go anywhere that night. But that's just another thing. But what kind of realistic issues do people have? You mentioned something before we started about an island and just getting resources on and off an island. And right now, would you say Nantucket had issues
up in Massachusetts, where parts of Massachusetts got over close to 3 feet, 2.5 to 3 feet, maybe a little bit more than that of snow. And the entire island of Nantucket off the coast of Massachusetts was without power for an extended period of time, still without power at the time that I was checking in before recording this. And one of the biggest issues they had was they couldn't get the power trucks there until the weather calmed down enough that they could reopen the ferry service and ferry the equipment over there to start working on the power lines.
Good grief. So what do you people do when you don't have electricity? How do you keep yourselves warm?
Well, we make, there's a couple of things. In the wintertime, you know, it, some people may be lucky enough to have a wood stove or a pellet stove or a fireplace in their home. Some people have generators that can make use of that and to power the essential equipment to keep their home warm. And then without that, then you fall back on neighborhood shelter centers and places that that can serve as shelters for people without power. And we saw that happen. That happened actually recently yesterday in, I believe, Wilmington, Delaware, nearby here. They had a transformer go, and an apartment building with 100 apartments in it was on served by power for that, for electric power, for heat and everything else. And when the transformer blew and they couldn't get one installed for like 12 hours and it was overnight on a cold night, everybody in the apartment complex was evacuated and sent to a shelter because they needed to place that had heat.
Well, and especially when you're dealing with small children and the elderly, you've got, you know,
right.
kind of triples
right.
the problem.
So, you know, it's an issue, and you just you make do. You hopefully are prepared for staying it out and managing with the cold. The good news is most homes are well insulated in our area, and so it takes a day or so for in cold weather for all of the heat to leave the building. You know, a couple of days. You know, it can get chilly, but it'll take a couple of days for it to get down to the point where, you know, you got to worry about freezing pipes and things like that. So you can, it's livable, it's habitable if you keep the doors closed and manage your heat, what little heat you have.
Well, it says a lot for, and we've talked about this, although not for a while, personal preparedness. And you're talking about people getting upset because the locals are putting too much effort into emergency preparedness. But people still kind of live under a rock sometimes and think, this can never happen to us. It's going to happen to somebody else. And people have to take responsibility for themselves, their own homes, their families, have caches of supplies, have a plan if the electricity goes out. I have an alternate place to go, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it is important for communities to be prepared and to do the things they're supposed to do. And I think, you know, the people that are complaining in New York City have really short memories because Hurricane Sandy came through there and did a deal on them. So I think they forget that this is the case.
Yes, I was there for that one. Thank you very much. I saw what that did. To Long Island. So, Joe, do you ever get weather that, I mean, we know you have, you know, tornadoes and such down there, but do you ever have weather to this level of extreme? You said it's going to be pretty cold over, tonight over there in Memphis.
It is, and you know, we certainly do get, I guess for us, the big event would be an ice event where, you know, we get lots of trees down, lots of power lines down. This part of the country, that's a pretty rare experience, and obviously the preparedness is less in regards to that, and the collective memory fades very quickly because that only happens once every few years. So it's probably been about 5 or 6 years since we had a pretty significant ice event here. But, you know, same kind of deal, no power for days, and I would say here the chances of having generators and that kind of stuff are probably significantly less because of the infrequency of those events.
Good point. The worst we have is here is Californians can't remember to drive how to drive in the rain. Of course, the problem is we haven't had any rain, so it hasn't been a problem, but yet not having the rain has been a problem. So what do you do? Anyway, so let's just, you and I, Joe, are called up to your USAR team and my DMAT are called to the East Coast for a severe weather event, a cold weather event like this. And when we looked at the stats for last year, Jamie discovered that people seem to really like some of the clinical subjects that we get into, and we haven't really done that for a while. So let's talk about hypothermia for a bit on a clinical level and from two different perspectives from the people we see. But first of all, how would you, as a USAR member and a USAR doc, prepare your team You know, for us, especially out here in California, when we go to a really cold weather event like that, we're not as mentally prepared, much less our bodies are hardly prepared for that level of cold. How do you handle that with your team when you're, especially when you're, you guys are having to work outside on top of buildings or potentially, or, you know, say you have a situation where a roof fell in, which happens a lot when you get really heavy snowfall and you're having to rescue people. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, apart from the obvious of, you know, thermal protection and clothing and warming centers and that sort of stuff, it's certainly a challenge. Trying to do that work when you are wearing multiple layers of clothing and gloves and that sort of stuff is difficult at best, and actually probably puts the workers at increased risk due to the loss of manual dexterity and cold fingers and all that other sort of stuff. So it's not only the common sense approaches, but it's a lot of awareness training around signs and symptoms of hypothermia, as well as the effects of that the weather and your response to the weather are going to have on your ability to work and your ability to see and your ability to maintain situational awareness in the environment. You know, you got a hood on and all that sort of stuff, and it's hard to hear, and you lose your peripheral vision a little bit because of your head's all wrapped up, and it's pretty easy to put yourself in a pretty dangerous situation.
So would you consider taking extra personnel just so you can switch them out so nobody's out in the cold for an extended period of time?
Well, we don't necessarily take additional personnel because we're limited in our footprint, but the we certainly would look at it from the standpoint of frequent team rotations and a warming center set up there to try to keep people functioning at their peak.
And it brings to mind, you know, it makes me think, Joe, thinking about what your team might respond to. And I think about the events that could occur in an area that are non-seasonal, like an earthquake, for instance, that could happen in the middle of wintertime in your region and cause major issues. Is this something you guys, you know, in your preparedness planning, you think about what happens if this occurs in a wintertime situation? Obviously, tornadoes tend to happen in summer months where hypothermia is not as much of an issue. But, you know, the tornado season hits in those different time frames. But an all-season event would be an earthquake or something like that, that would, you know, doesn't matter what time of the year it is, climate doesn't have any effect on it.
Well, you're exactly right. And we actually have a cold weather, kit, as it were, that, incorporates all the stuff that you would normally think of, as well as things like, chemical hand warmers and, wind protection stuff. And, The extra insulation for the tents and that sort of stuff that we don't necessarily carry along with us in more temperate times, just because it's a lot of weight and extra gear to carry around.
Yeah, and that just reminds me, and it was some years ago now, and I didn't go on this particular deployment, but we were sent up to Oregon or Washington for something or other, and none of those Californians had any real winter gear. And so they really, it was quite a logistics effort to make sure that we had everything we need, because we don't think about it. Most of the places we go, certainly around here, aren't that cold. But that's the thing. For your team, Joe, and ours, you could go anywhere. And now we're even going internationally. So God knows the extremes of temperature we might be exposed to that we're certainly not used to. And don't you agree that's kind of a stress in and of itself when you're acclimated to a certain type of weather? Like, I could probably tolerate heat maybe better than Jamie can, but he can certainly tolerate cold better than I can. And then suddenly you're thrown into this extreme environment.
Oh, I think that's exactly correct. You know, it's just a whole nother layer of complication that has to be taken into consideration. If you look at trying to, take care of a patient in an austere environment, that's orders of magnitude more difficult when the temperature is as bad as it is in the Northeast right now. I can't imagine trying to assess a patient, in a collapsed structure with 2 feet of snow. That's just logistically a nightmare, quite honestly.
And of course, it scares me just a little bit to think I'm actually having to go east in February, a little about a month from now. So I hope the weather calms down a little bit between now and then. But Joe, I want to throw a few questions at you. When is, of course, hypothermia is all relative based on symptoms, but when, you know, there's all these charts that we've seen, and certainly wind chill factor is one you have to be considered, but when does it become dangerous? And some material that I found said below 95 degrees, the situation becomes an emergency. So why is that the case? What happens at 90 or 95? Did I say 65? Certainly that would be a problem. 95 degrees, why is that a problem? What happens to the body at that point?
I think it's probably less about the specific temperature. Obviously, this is a continuum. And as, you know, core temperature drops, the effects become more pronounced. So, I don't know if it's necessarily all about a temperature as much as it is where you are in that spectrum. Some of the things that you see, obviously, are the neurologic effects of severe hypothermia. How much of that's related to changes in vascular permeability and perfusion in the head due to vasoconstriction and all that sort of stuff is difficult to ascertain versus just the direct effects of cold at the cellular level. You certainly get a lot of cardiovascular effects as well where you're more sensitive to arrhythmias, and the persistent lack of peripheral circulation, including at some point, you know, your brain, simply makes you more and more dysfunctional. Or even if your brain's working pretty well, you can't get your fingers to work well enough to take care of the whatever you need to do to protect yourself or rewarm yourself. So it's
That is one question I had, because you always see these movies about this guy, you know, up in the mountains after the plane crash, and he has one dry match, but his fingers won't work well enough for him to strike the darn thing and start the fire. Why is it we lose that fine motor control when we're hypothermic? Is it just the actual cold to the fingers itself, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think you're seeing the peripheral vasoconstriction due to the severe cold and the attempts by the body to maintain the core temperature at the expense of the peripheral parts of your body. And obviously those tissues are becoming ischemic, the nerve is becoming ischemic. At some point the tissue itself is actually becoming so cold as to begin to get freezing of the water that's inside the cell. That's what frostbite is. It's a progressive thing that goes on with several different things happening that are resulting in the ultimate loss of dexterity and sensation and all those different features.
And you mentioned, and throw in any time you want, Jamie, but you mentioned something about cardiovascular effects. And having worked ski patrol for many years, we had to do search and rescue missions, and usually it was the end of the day when it was really cold. And, of course, it was always in the middle of a blizzard when somebody went offsides somewhere, and we had to find them. But one of the things they always told us was if someone was very hypothermic, we had to be very careful in how we moved them because of the potential of throwing them into V-fib. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, there's no question that the heart is much more sensitive to arrhythmias when it's cold. I don't know that I know the pathophysiology behind that, but certainly the that's in folklore, if nothing else. And this idea of, you know, moving those people more gently and, not doing things like a precordial thump back in the day and all that was certainly pretty common knowledge. I think there's been some reports of that in the literature. I really think it's probably not as frequently seen and obviously common as education would imply. There's certainly something to be said for it. It's not to say that it doesn't occur, but I think it's probably, not as big a deal as has been made out to be. Certainly there is some truth to the refractoriness of those arrhythmias that are related to severe hypothermia. So, you know, medications like lidocaine and that sort of stuff just don't seem to work as well in severe hypothermia situations. And interestingly enough, Ritalin seems to be a better drug, but of course you can't get Ritalin.
It is. Yeah, you can't get it. I remember reading about that. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I think it's not that stuff doesn't happen. I don't know that it's as prominent an issue as it seems to be in the kind of standard education about that. But the bottom line is the people who are hypothermic are much more prone to spontaneously generated arrhythmias. And I can certainly appreciate a thought process that says, well, anything that is provides some mild electrical stimulus to the heart may be enough to prompt the arrhythmia. And, handling people roughly or falling down or getting hit in the chest or whatever certainly generates, small amounts of electrical energy. And I can also understand how that might, be just enough to elicit an arrhythmia. So,
well, the interesting thing about hypothermia that you don't find on its opposite side is there seems to be a protective mechanism that your vital signs could still be functioning, but to the point where we can't even perceive them. So that's why on ski patrol, we always said they're not dead till they're warm and dead. And I know that's the case in medicine in general. And every once in a while, you'll hear some amazing case about it. I remember once a three-year-old stumbled outside in the middle of a winter's night, and they found this kid sickle the next morning. And so somebody came along and started CPR, and there was a paramedic in the neighborhood, and there was a pediatrician, and they end up going to this community hospital, then to a children's hospital. They did like 6 hours of CPR on this kid and brought him back, and he ended up with no neurodeficits. How does something like that happen?
Well, I think that's the same, neuroprotective mechanism behind therapeutic hypothermia that we use for cardiac arrest now.
Good point.
So, it's that significant slowdown in metabolic processes, I think probably works on a lot of different levels. I think part of that is the reduced need for metabolic material, because all those processes are moving very slowly, so you don't need as much oxygen, you don't produce as much CO2, etc. But I think that hypothermia probably also does have a very suppressive effect on some of the other biochemical pathways that lead to things like oxygen free radicals and inflammatory mediators and vascular permeability mediators and all these other biochemical signs of inflammation and swelling and all that sort of stuff that are ultimately what caused the neurological injury after the event. When you get, big changes in vascular permeability, big changes in perfusion pressures and changes in inflammation and swelling in the neuron itself and all of those things. So I think that coolness is protective in many ways, in that it kind of shuts many of those processes down, or at least slows them down enough that they can, you can reduce the effect of those things. And that kind of fits into a lot of the cardiac research now in looking at sort of things like stutter CPR, where in addition to therapeutic hypothermia, you provide a little bit of perfusion for a few minutes and then you stop for 30 seconds or so, and then you reperfuse for 30 seconds and then you stop and then you reperfuse and, continue perfusing after that. The idea behind that is to provide the mitochondria in the cell with a little bit of the stuff it needs to start working, and then give it about 30 seconds to let it kind of get comfortable with that, and then give it a little more, and then let it rest again, and then gradually take it back to full speed, as opposed to, you know, dumping that stuff back in there very quickly and having the mitochondria produce a lot of stuff that you don't actually want and ultimately is harmful to the cell.
Sounds like you're trying to fuel up an old carburetor and feed a little bit at a time.
That's a great analogy. I mean, it's some pretty interesting research to look at that and see that there's something to this kind of stutter process of reperfusion that seems to be beneficial.
You know, it's reminding me of the, perhaps similarly to the reperfusion type thing that occurs with a crush injury, you know, when we've stopped the crush and all of these materials from the tissue that's been crushed for a period of time start running through the system. Is there some similarity to that?
Yeah, I think there probably is some similarity in there. Between those two things, it seems to be about how quickly you reintroduce nutrients, and I use that term very broadly to mean everything from oxygen to glucose to, you know, carrying away the bad humors. But how quickly you reintroduce those things to tissue that's been ischemic. And if you introduce it slowly and with some intermittency to it, those tissues seem to, those cells tend to do better and respond better and have less cell death and all that sort of stuff that goes along with that. So, you know, I think it really just, I think, has to do with any sort of ischemic tissue at all.
Well, that's fascinating. I'll have to do a little more research on stutter CPR. You never know what's out there. One of the little factoids I have said, prolonged exposure to cold will eventually use up your body's stored energy. How does that work?
Well, it's just the body converts an awful lot of those biochemical mediators into heat. Whether it's simply by trying to crank up your metabolic processes or by, you know, physical activity like shivering, which uses lots and lots of energy. And that's basically all you're trying to do there is to increase the amount of energy that you can produce to generate higher core temperatures as you try to battle the environment itself.
Yeah, good point. I'm only on the first page, and we're already like at the end of this podcast. I think we could go forever here. There's just so much good material. But one thing I want to throw out is, even in our day-to-day medicine, and I think it's something that we miss quite a lot, especially this time of year, is with the elderly and the fact that they can be clinically hypothermic even when we walk into a home that isn't particularly cold and uncomfortable to us. Is it just the fact that an older person's body does not respond to the extremes of heat and cold the way it used to?
I certainly think that's part of it. They have much less body fat in general. The skin is much thinner. They're much more insensitive to fluid loss and heat loss. Especially if they have things like peripheral neuropathies and that sort of stuff, you know, they don't realize how old their feet are and they end up losing an awful lot of heat out of their feet. And of course, all the blood that flows through there is cooled down as it passes through there. So, you know, it's easy for them to get themselves in trouble before they realize it. And they simply don't have the reserves to battle it off once it gets started.
Okay, I got one more question I have to ask, and this is something that's always, I've always wondered about. You see the movie again where you got the guy in the plane crash and he's a survivor and he's helping all these other people. And then he lays down in the snow and says, okay, I think I'm just going to die now. And the theory is that somehow hypothermia affects the mind to the point where people can become even apathetic about their own survival. What do you know about that, Dr. Joe? That's always something that's fascinated me.
Well, me as well, and it certainly does seem to be a fairly recognized entity with severe hypothermia, that you get a you lose your judgment capability, and you know it's certainly been seen in folks who are in those situations. They begin stripping off clothing and all sorts of stuff. There's certainly been many episodes of searches in the mountains for folks who, you know, lost hikers and that sort of stuff, who were found via a trail of their, you know, heavy clothing, despite the fact that they're in a high in the mountains where the temperatures are very cold. And that's felt to be part of the end stage of the hypothermia process, is that you begin to lose that judgment, that you need to keep that stuff on, and you start stripping it off.
Fascinating. Well, I assume in your training at Paragon that you guys incorporate some of this extreme temperature training in what you do and all the different training that you do.
Yeah, that's a good point, Sam, because I was going to ask the same question, because I think I know you guys travel all over to different places to do training. And I assume, based upon the fact that you're so focused on this experiential training, that you try to bring aspects of a given area's climate and consideration for their types of events into play.
Well, you guys are exactly right. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about hypothermia from a disaster medicine standpoint is that because of the time delays built into disaster response, you know, folks will tend to be hypothermic already. In other words, they've been there for a while and they've had time to get hypothermic. And part of what the real challenge is to try to deal with the differential diagnosis of a patient who has a change in mental status and a subnormal temperature, to figure out, you know, is this just simple hypothermia? Are they hypoglycemic because they've been trying to stay warm? Do they have a head injury? Is that why they're goofy? Are they septic because they've got an open wound and they've been stuck in a, you know, exposed to sewage for the last 2 days? You know, there's a very, very complex differential diagnosis going on there to try to sort out what all is going on with those people before you know, sort of write them off as another head injury and try to move on to somebody else.
And of course, it doesn't help that, especially with older people, we don't know what their baseline mentality is anyway.
Exactly.
Know, what's their normal mentation? So it could be this, it could be that, it could be normal. Who knows?
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, one of the things that is important for people listening to the show and considering maybe bringing some kind of specialized training or events into their system to help people be better prepared, that one of the things Paragon is really good at doing is adapting their training modules and scenarios to a given area and bring these into play. And we should point out that even though we've been talking about hypothermia in terms of extreme cold weather, it doesn't, you know, we can induce hypothermia a lot of different ways, no matter what the exterior climate might be. And it can be, you know, a 60-degree nice fall or spring day can turn into, a hypothermia event for somebody that's trapped in a wet environment for an extended period of time in a disaster situation. So we have to keep all of these things in mind, even in times when we aren't worried about sub-zero temperatures. We can still end up with patients that have a core body temperature that has fallen significantly.
Oh, really good point.
Absolutely right, Jamie. Anything, you know, below normal body temperature, especially when you're wet and if you're in direct contact, for example, wet and stuck next to a big piece of concrete, will pull heat out of people very, very quickly and make you hypothermic, even when it's a relatively temperate day outside.
I think someone back there on the East Coast needs to invite Jim and Joe to come and do a training in 6 feet of snow, and we'll see how that works.
Yeah, I'll send Jim for that one.
Since he's not here, yeah, that's what happens when you're not here.
That's right. You're
volunteered.
Well, if they want to get a hold of you or find out more about what Paragon Medical Education Group does, where can they find you guys on the web?
Well, we're on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and the same moniker on Facebook. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, where you can also find the podcast.
Excellent. And Sam, how about you?
Well, it's pretty easy. I'm on the usual social media places, SamBradley11. You can pretty much find me anywhere. And most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And where do we find the PodMedic?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media sites. And, of course, my various podcasts, including the Disaster Podcast, can be found over at MedicCast.com. But, of course, for this purposes of this show, we want to find you, and you can find us over at DisasterPodcast.com, where we hope you'll check out other episodes, leave a comment or a question in the comments area for any of the episodes. That emails us automatically, and we can get back in touch with you and answer your questions there on the comments area or directly by email. So definitely reach out to us and let us know if you like this episode. We kind of got a sense as we were looking at last year's episodes that people seem to download more frequently the clinical-based episodes. So we're going to try to do a few more of those more frequently and get that discussion out there. But, you know, Sam, I mean, I was thinking about our topic, you know, talking about hypothermia, and it's one thing to deal with one hypothermic patient, but when you start thinking about dealing with masses of people with hypothermia and people that are trapped or for prolonged periods of time and trying to deal with managing those patients, it's a little bit different than your typical dealing with an emergency with a single patient.
And Jamie, I think we're talking a whole new podcast right there. That could be a whole subject in and of itself. But it's pretty clear when we're talking about this type of thing that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.